The information in this podcast is meant for the education of clinicians in rehabilitation. This is not meant for personal medical diagnosis and treatment, and individuals should always consult an appropriate medical practitioner.
Hello, and welcome to the ANPT Vestibular Special Interest Group podcast on integrating psychology into vestibular rehab. My name is Maureen Clancy, and I'm joined today by Emily Kostelnik and Joanna Wolfson. Emily Kostelnik is a clinical health psychologist specializing in vestibular disorders. She lives with multiple vestibular disorders. She has had two surgical repairs for superior canal dehiscence and has experienced BPPVV, vestibular migraine, and 3PD. She now focuses on behavioral health education for the vestibular community through her company, Ruta Behavioral Education, and provides licensed consultation and therapy through her private practice, the Vestibular Psychologist. Joanna Wolfson is a senior psychologist on the Adult Outpatient Service at Rusk Rehabilitation, NYU Langone Health, and Clinical Assistant Professor of Rehabilitation Medicine at the NYU Grossman School of Medicine. She holds a doctorate in clinical psychology from Fairleigh Dickinson University, completed her internship at NYU Rusk, and did a postdoctoral fellowship at the Manhattan VA in health psychology and primary care. She is board certified in clinical health psychology. Dr. Wolfson provides individual and group psychotherapy to patients with a wide range of medical presentations, including vestibular conditions, and co-leads a vestibular stress management group. Thank you both for joining me today.
Thank you. We're excited to be here.
So my first question is, what role does psychology have in treating patients with vestibular disorders?
I can chime in and get us started, I guess. So this is Joanna Wolfson, by the way. So I know Emily and I both do very similar things coming from different backgrounds. And so we're both psychologists who treat patients with vestibular conditions. And so, you know, in the role that I'm in here at NYU Medical Center, we see a lot of people with varying vestibular disorders through our vestibular clinic. And I'd say psychology is a little bit different with this population than I would think of if I was going to like a long-term psychotherapist to just talk about past relationship issues or life stressors. But it's really focused on the interplay between people's physical symptoms, which we know causes a lot of stress and anxiety. That's a very normal response to having physical symptoms that feel very out of control. And so it's a way to sort of calm the part of the brain that feels the stress and feels the anxiety. And so whether that be through just education about why that happens in the first place, you know, why our brains kind of sound the alarm bells when our bodies feel out of control, that's often where psychology providers might start to things like introducing and teaching different relaxation techniques and ways of grounding the body or calming the body, to ways of just thinking about symptoms from a cognitive perspective that might help to feel less frightened. So that's sort of a basic overview of maybe what psychology would do.
Thank you, Joanna. I think that hit the highlights very well. Just to add, I guess, some stats behind it. We know that people with vestibular disorders or chronic dizziness are 3 times more likely to have anxiety, depression, or panic disorders. And that tends to map onto the diagnoses that have a more chronic presentation. So like Meniere's disease, vestibular migraine, and triple PD. That tends to be less true for things like BPPV or vestibular neuritis, not to say that that can't be true. But I think beyond just the anxiety or depression, mental health providers are experts in behavior, and living with a vestibular disorder requires different behavioral regimens that we have to follow. And I'd say we, because I'm a vestibular patient myself as well. And so that might be medication regimens. It might be lifestyle changes like movement, exercise. It might be dietary changes. It might be nervous system techniques, whatever it might be. And so people can have challenges trying to implement those things on top of the symptoms that we might be experiencing. And so I think I want to make it clear for the audience here, whether that's patients or providers, that the mental health or behavioral health provider, the role isn't necessarily just for someone experiencing high levels of anxiety and depression. I think it can really be of benefit to most people who are going through vestibular treatment.
No, I think that's true. I don't think a lot of times patients are necessarily referred to psychology when they have a vestibular condition. And when should a PT, a physical therapist, like what would they see in their patient that would make them think that they would benefit from seeing a psychologist?
I can jump in on this one, Joanna. I think we can look more, we can look at both objective assessment and then we can look more at maybe behavioral observations. And so from an objective assessment perspective, it might be the GAD-7 or the PHQ-9 and looking specifically at markers of like this person is experiencing high anxiety or high or low mood. Or how the patient presents. So that might be looking at their affect. Like, does the patient look have a very flat affect, meaning like you don't see a lot of emotion on their face? Perhaps they look, they're not showing happiness or sadness. Perhaps they're very tearful in sessions. Maybe you notice psychomotor agitation. So they're very twitchy, their legs are shaking, that type of thing. Maybe they seem very overwhelmed. They're like, I don't know how to implement all of these things. I don't know what my life is going to look like. Maybe listening for catastrophic type language, like my life is ruined. I'm never going to get better. I'm not going to be a good mom. I'm not going to be able to work, et cetera. Also examining like social support and what that might look like and what supports they have in place in their community or at home. Another thing that I've noticed in my practice is isn't necessarily based on any literature, is this actually there is one study on trauma and kind of the relationship between a history of trauma and how we experience vestibular symptoms. But we know that a history of trauma kind of puts our nervous system into this fight or flight or this activated state, which makes us more likely to be hypervigilant about our bodily sensations. So scanning our body for safety, scanning our environment for safety. And then if we notice some small sensation that might seem out of place, we put our attention on it. That makes it grow. That engages kind of a negative neuroplasticity process. I have noticed, again, this part is not based on research. This is just my clinical observation. Patients with very high DHIs, so dizziness handicap inventory, so I would say 70, 80, 90 plus, I'm always looking for a history of trauma. I've just noticed this connection with people who are reporting the highest level of severity and symptoms. I'm looking for that hypervigilant piece. I'm looking for like what has contributed to this nervous system activation, which I would say the nervous system activation piece is present in most patients, but to varying degrees, of course. So I hope that gives maybe some ideas of things to look for.
That was actually, Emily, I'll just say, really interesting what you said for me about the DHI and trauma, and not something that I had sort of been alerted to before, but I think that makes such a good point and so much sense in thinking about like other ways of looking at these functional inventories that might highlight underlying nervous system elevated states. And the one thing I'll add about I work part of my job is working with the physical therapists here through our vestibular service. And sometimes the one thing that they will say tip them off to refer to psychology is in the session, the patient's worry or anxiety really getting in the way of being able to complete the exercises. So fearfulness about doing the next step because they really don't trust that they're going to be okay, specifically, of course, feeling a lot of symptoms with an exercise or worry about, well, what happens when I leave and I'm going to be dizzy for days. And so sometimes that is a nice tipper for them just when it's really getting in the way of patients progressing to the next step because some of the worry and anxiety or stress is just a barrier for moving forward.
Speaking about the DHI, I think that's a really interesting point, and there is the subsections within there. I don't know if you've noticed patients would benefit more from mental health intervention if they score higher on the emotional component or not. I don't know if that's anything that anybody has looked into or if it's more just kind of anecdotal at this point.
I mean, I have personally haven't seen any papers on that. I think it would make sense. But when I'm looking at the DHI, I'm not necessarily breaking it down by the different
Domains.
categories. Yeah. Joanna, I don't know if you have different experience with that.
And actually, there's the way that the dichotomy is within the clinic here is, the physical therapists are often the ones giving that. So they give the DHI, and then this, and often what Emily mentioned earlier, the PHQ, a mood indicator, and the GAD-7, which is our anxiety indicator. And so I'm more familiar with the mental health measures, but in just the literature I do know about is that there's, a high relationship between the GAD-7 score and then actual sort of functional outcomes as shown both in person and then on the DHI. And the other piece of that is just the norms of all of these, but specifically with the DHI, there's not been a lot of just for people that maybe aren't like American-born white individuals, there's not a lot of research on is this actually also capturing expression of symptoms like in a wide range of cultures. So I think there's some questions about how do we even like break down into sections depending on someone's background. But certainly the high scores, no matter what, are really telling us about how someone's doing out in the world.
Yes, right. And something we should be looking at and kind of analyzing and deciding what to do with our patients. How, as a PT, would somebody find a provider for their patient that they think would be appropriate? Like, what's their best avenues to look into that?
Coming from the hospital setting, should a physical therapist work there? There's like a nice avenue often where psychology might be involved, but it is, first of all, I think a very unique specialty. I met Emily in part because there aren't so many psychologists that work specifically with the vestibular population, and so it becomes sort of a smaller community. But short of having a psychologist or psychotherapist that works with that population, usually people who identify as a behavioral health provider or a health psychologist, a rehabilitation psychologist, or even people that have worked with any form of pain or chronic illness, usually have a good sense of the ways that they might intervene also with, chronic vestibular symptoms. Aside, so some of it is just making connections if possible with any local medical centers where these types of individuals might exist. And often those settings also take a wider range of insurances. But I'll pass it to Emily. I'm sure you
Yeah,
interface in that way.
I mean, I was going to echo what you said about I find chronic pain has a really strong overlap with chronic dizziness. And there are a wide variety of mental health or behavioral health providers trained in chronic pain, especially with like the VA kind of really emphasizing that and having specific pain clinics. I think a lot of our training have gone through like VA hospitals, for example. But exact websites, I think like Psychology Today, you can sort it based on your location and if you want virtual or in person and chronic pain or chronic illness and then insurances that they might take. I personally, when I started my practice, I would say I did a combination of like cognitive behavioral therapy and acceptance and commitment therapy, which are kind of the two modalities that have been studied with vestibular disorders. And over time, I've started to favor acceptance and commitment therapy or ACT. Just in my clinical experience, I think I find it resonates better with the population specifically that I work with in my private practice. So if someone were interested in ACT specifically, there's an organization called Contextual Sciences. It's contextualsciences.org. You can find an ACT provider there. There's also, this is for private practice, something called Open Path Collective, where people with sliding scale spots in their practices might advertise on there. So if someone, for example, doesn't have insurance or they're looking for lower cost services, they might look there. And I would say we were talking about this before we started filming, but there is an interjurisdictional compact for psychologists called PsyPact. which has really opened the doors for psychologists in the country to be able to do provide virtual therapy really nationwide, 30 to 39 states, or some that aren't part of the that aren't part of SciPact. But I think that has really opened doors for different specialists to work with people around the country. I think right now it's maybe a little bit hard to find those people, like that might be credentialed through SciPact, but I think there are some great online resources.
Oh, that's wonderful information and one that we don't necessarily know off the top of our heads. So very helpful to provide that. If a therapist is treating a patient and within that actual treatment session, or they notice over the course of a couple of treatment sessions that the patient is struggling a little bit or demonstrating some anxiety, is there something that they could do either within the treatment session or to help to bridge the gap between like the physical therapist and their mental health provider?
I would say the biggest thing, and one of the biggest things I focus on in my practice is the nervous system and calming the nervous system. And I've started to incorporate more somatic type-based therapies as well, because I find cognitive therapies are great and they have a place, but sometimes we're missing that body part of it. Like patients might say, cognitively, I understand that maybe my thinking is unrealistically negative or whatever it might be, but my body doesn't feel consistent with that cognitive knowledge, if that makes sense. So I would say things like diaphragmatic breathing, five senses grounding. I think especially in this population, with a lot of patients having visual dependence and visual vertigo and just struggling with being out in the world and grocery stores and busy visual environments, et cetera, teaching people to focus on proprioception and what that means of like, how do my feet feel on the ground? How does my back feel against the chair? That touch sensation is super important in this population. So I think those would be kind of the tips that I feel like could bridge the gap between PT and then like a more formal behavioral health therapy.
Yeah, and I'll quickly add, I think everything Emily said similarly is within my thoughts. And often patients will say sometimes by the time they are referred to psychology, they will have learned, let's say, a breathing technique with their physical therapist and will say something like, they're very committed to the physical therapy, but they're like, the single most helpful thing I've learned, to help with that overlap between my symptoms and the anxiety is the breathing. And they'll already come in having known that. And I think just sort of maybe a message for any physical therapist, on the line is that there is so much overlap anyway between what physical therapy is already doing and what mental health providers would do, especially when it comes to kind of like graded exposure. So the other important piece for anxiety is sort of the patient's experience that I was scared, but I did it anyway. I was worried about, I felt nervous about being dizzy, but I recognized that I could do it with dizziness and was safe. And so if a physical therapist can kind of echo that feeling, we're first going to breathe and calm the body. We're then going to do this exercise. If you feel dizzy, that is expected, and sort of that psychoeducation about the expectations for dizziness and that you can be dizzy, but it doesn't mean that something awful is happening. Just those few things are kind of psychotherapy techniques.
Okay, so there's probably things that people are doing already and, not necessarily knowing that
For sure.
it's helping in the way that they think they are. So, and I do think that we do tend to, as a stimulus therapist, do a lot of graded things, to gradual exposure, especially in the vestibular population, just so that they can, we don't want someone to get so ramped up that they can't do things for 3 days afterwards, right? So like gradually exposing them to all of that is in their best interest too. So
The
then they,
last, yeah.
yeah,
Yeah,
then they're
last.
gonna like trust you better too. So.
The one line I really like just about learning in particular is just that, no learning happens in a state of high anxiety. So if we think about a stressometer where zero is completely calm and 10 is panicking, usually the danger zone of like 8 to 10 is where it's really hard for anything to click. So if people are, completely panicking, then any form of vestibular therapy or often even trying to teach them grounding is not really helpful. So just like letting the body calm, we're going to just sit here for 5 minutes and just breathe, and once we feel a little calmer, then let's do something very basic, and kind of letting letting the learning start to take over when not panicking.
When they're out of that state. What would you suggest if a physical therapist feels that a patient would really benefit from seeing a mental health provider, but they are reluctant to do so? Is there any suggestions that we could offer them?
Well, that, I think that happens. And I think it happens in part because, one, it depends how the message is delivered, I think. Emily and I talk about this a lot. And so sometimes a patient, by the time they've gotten to physical therapy, have been to a year or two of providers where they've maybe felt passed around the medical system, or like they've gotten, some have said they've gotten the words, this is all anxiety, or they've heard something like, this is all in your head. And so, you know, there's a big stigma to those phrases. And most people don't, that doesn't sit well, you know, to say everything you're feeling is just going to be chalked up to anxiety. And so we're kind of going to discount the part where we can help. So sometimes people are hesitant or reluctant for that reason, that they don't want to be boiled down to, you know, one more provider who maybe thinks that they can't help me, but if I was only less anxious. So, you know, I think part of it is sort of acknowledging and just letting the patient know that what they're feeling physically is very real, and kind of starting with that, and almost normalizing the fact that these symptoms, for almost anyone, the brain is doing what it should be doing, which is having a reaction to this and feeling stressed and worried or anxious about this. And any healthy brain will actually do that. And, you know, I think often the language of treating a psychologist, not necessarily as a standalone psychologist where you'll be on the couch talking about, you know, long histories, but rather that we have someone who's part of the team. And most people that we see, you know, at some point are referred just to consult with this person with sort of low stakes and low pressure, and making the point that this is very different from, you know, seeking out therapy because of, let's say, uncontrolled depression that is, has sort of an unclear cause. But I'm going to pass it. I know, Emily, you probably have some things to say about this as well.
Yeah, I think you hit on a lot of them. I think normalizing like that this is kind of a survival response and your brain is trying to protect you. I have personally moved away from even using the term anxiety and couching it more in nervous system and explaining like what is the autonomic nervous system and what is sympathetic arousal versus the parasympathetic rest and digest. So I think that that works well, although granted the people who are working with me have already come to my office, so I recognize we have to kind of bridge that gap. But I think being careful about the language that you use, like I feel like the word anxiety itself is has a stigma associated with it, and someone might shut down when they hear that. And so using more physiologic language around the biology of it and the nervous system. I remember when I was in training in various kind of integrated settings, we would use the term behavioral health consultant rather than like psychotherapist, for example. And I think also giving the patient expectations about what that might look like. So when I work with people, it's very short term, it's very skills and education oriented rather than like there's this long term, never ending deep dive into childhood, for example, if you want to put it that way. I think another really good skill for physical therapists, I know this one might require some kind of continuing education, but is a motivational interviewing around, you know, getting the patient to recognize like how motivated or how likely are they to seek behavioral health consultation. And if they don't, like how might their life look different or the same a year from now, and kind of getting them to think in their own language, in their own words, putting it in their own voice. And that can really sort of help move people through stages of change.
To Emily's point too about the integrated care settings, I always think, you know, what would be ideal, and this goes back to the postdoc and other practicums as a grad student that I had done in primary care settings, but is this model, which is so nice, about almost a shared medical appointment. And the ability for a psychologist or a mental health provider or behavioral health provider of any kind to sort of be there for the taking when appropriate. And it would look something like just inviting that provider with the patient's permission just to say hello in a session. And I think there's, usually the big disconnect between someone being recommended to see a psychologist and seeing one is like the time in between being handed a referral, having to the burden of making a call, the wait list, the insurance barriers. So I know this is sort of like a fantasy world, but if there are providers in the same hospital and there's the opportunity to just have that person pop in, provide a card, say, hello, I'm here, a little bit about what I do, I'm part of the team. And I think patients don't always realize it's really a casual conversation focused on problem solving. And as Emily said, I say this could be 4 sessions if we want. It could be 3 months, but usually we can get the job done trying to help understand this is like we expect improvement, from this. It's not just let's throw a dart and see where it lands.
What would be about the average time that you would see a patient for who has a vestibular disorder? And what would an individual treatment session look like for that particular person?
Emily and I, we work in different settings at the moment, but if really the goal is to, as Emily said again, really focus on reducing that nervous system response, between psychoeducation, sort of nervous system response, maybe cognitive behavioral therapy, and encouraging some exposures along with the PT. When we look at studies are about 8 sessions with actual like CBT for vestibular conditions. And here we usually do anything between like 8 and 12 sessions is a pretty typical treatment course. What I'll say is that sometimes, there's the part of the reaction loop that I think Emily and I are talking a lot about, where the brain has a response to the symptoms and then, fight or flight has its own vestibular symptoms associated with it. So that's why that is the response that we're trying to target. But separate from that, sometimes people have had, as Emily said earlier, trauma or chronic stress. And when chronic stress and trauma are part of the picture, we have cases where that alone can lead to people developing vulnerabilities within their immune system, their vestibular system, their gut. So sometimes when that's the case, people do benefit ultimately from longer-term psychotherapy to address the chronic stress or the trauma. But when it comes to vestibular psychology, sometimes the model that's helpful is let's just do these like nervous system grounding, breathing, progressive muscle relaxation techniques, and just get something practical under control. And then let's see what we're left with. And if we need other therapy after that, then we'll help the person find that.
Yeah, I think that's pretty consistent with what I see as well. I think it depends on other comorbidities, their history, kind of what Joanna was saying. I would say if it's strictly for kind of the psychoeducation, skills building, and they're on top of doing their homework and kind of practicing these things, on the short end, I would say maybe 6 sessions. I would say 6 to 12. But again, there are those people with the more significant trauma histories. So how I handle that myself is I will either refer out for like a trauma-specific therapy, or I will continue to see them myself. I'm kind of in a unique situation in that I have vestibular diagnoses as well. And so I find people are like, you're the only person that has been able to understand. And so it can be hard to transition them along. Like they might want to continue to see me. So I would say I have both ends of the continuum with I would say more patients on the short-term end.
Okay. No, that's helpful information. I think gives people a perspective as to like what time frame they should expect to be going through, to get help for this. Is there any like applications, like apps for people's phones that you would recommend, or that you found to be helpful for patients, if they're in like a, particular vestibular, like heightened frame of mind at that point in time?
Oh, I can jump in.
Sure.
I think my favorite for meditations is Insight Timer, just because it has so many free options. Although with that number of options, that can be a little bit overwhelming as well. I also like the Tapping Solutions app. I've gotten into emotional freedom technique tapping and found it actually to be very helpful for me as a patient too, as well as with the people that I work with. And yeah, Joanna, I don't know if you want to jump in.
Yeah, no, Emily and I were talking about this the other day, and we're trying to compare notes on what we might recommend. Often, I will say patients recommend to us what they've used and what helps. And so, I think most people have heard of the apps Calm and Headspace. That's the ones I hear about the most. And I think it doesn't really matter what people's preferences are, as long as people find that they have something. I think of it a little bit as an app that provides something like a cue control, which is, as soon as you hear that moderator's voice that's soothing, you feel your body relax, and once that is sort of the connection, then really take your pick. There's so many apps out there, and I can't keep up. Emily and I can't keep up with what's free these days. What's the free content, what's changing. So there's none that I feel don't look into. You can really not go wrong. One of my personal favorite kind of websites and mindfulness meditation providers is Tara Brach, Brach. And again, I haven't been to the website in a little while, but her voice is very soothing. And she is one of the gurus of kind of mindfulness. And so there's a lot of archives, and her libraries have some good content where you can access things that are anywhere from 5 minutes to, almost an hour. So that's one other go-to I've recommended.
Those are all great ideas. Is there any other suggestions that you have, anything that we didn't touch upon so far for either patients who are experiencing a vestibular disorder or the providers who are treating the patients?
One thing that just came to mind as we were talking about the apps is if meditation feels difficult for you, if it feels even inaccessible to someone, that's not your fault. It's okay. It doesn't mean there's something wrong with you. Sometimes, especially with a history of trauma and kind of piled on medical trauma and getting to this point of experiencing chronic symptoms, the nervous system can be so activated that even any sense of trying to calm it down, your body can perceive as a threat. And so sometimes people do better with more active forms of nervous system calming, if you want to put it that way, but like a mindful walk, for example, or Joanna mentioned before, progressive muscle relaxation, something that's a bit more active than just sitting in the quiet, which can I have found can make some people feel worse. And so I think it's great to put the apps out there and, like Joanna was talking about, more like a classical conditioning to like a calming voice. But I just want people to know that if that's not accessible for you right now, it doesn't mean that will always be that way. And to just honor your body and listen to what your body is saying feels comfortable in the moment.
I know earlier Emily brought up, and we kind of alluded to, like a senses grounding technique. And actually, the physical therapist at our site had asked me, what exactly is that? And so one of the ways to do it is just focusing for a patient on five things you can see in your surroundings, four things that you can touch, and actually reaching out and touching them and noticing the feel, three sounds you can hear, two things you can smell, and one thing you can taste, and actually smelling and tasting these things. And there are variations on this, but that people can find this like incredibly, it's just one way to kind of bring the body and the mind from kind of spiraling upwards to, okay, I'm here, I'm safe, I'm in this environment, really focuses the attention in a way that I think sometimes people knowing like exactly what to recommend to a patient and how to teach it is helpful. The other thing I think we haven't Just one quick thing is, I'm sure through this podcast before, the Vestibular Disorders Association's, website has been recommended, but they also have a lot of support groups. And so sometimes patients just looking to that, or looking to, some people benefit from Facebook groups and other people say it feels like too much, overwhelming or not really their stories, but somewhere that's often moderated by someone, and many are moderated by people who've had vestibular disorders themselves. And just a community where people feel not alone, I think, can be very important. So it doesn't necessarily focus on some of the strategies Emily and I were talking about, but I think feeling isolated is obviously one major component of dealing with these conditions, and to be in a setting where other people speak the same language. Patients sometimes are like, that's the most helpful intervention that I've gotten yet.
Oh, that's a great idea. Quick question about like the five senses grounding. If a therapist was going to do it with the patient, do you recommend that they review that with the patient before they get started with anything else? Or like what would the timing work with that? Because obviously I think if the patient gets like highly ramped up, that's we talked about, they're not going to learn anything during that time frame. So what would be the appropriate approach for that?
I mean, I think ideally, I always think about how do we take like a prophylactic stress management approach. So we really don't want to do these things when we're so activated that it doesn't feel like it works. Because breathing, sometimes people are like, it didn't work. And well, people were kind of too far gone at that point. So I'm a fan of, and I think some of the physical therapists too, of almost if they know it's a patient who can, kind of go from 0 to 60 pretty quickly, just using it all the time at the start of a session. No matter what, we've learned it. I'll teach it to you. I'll tell you about it. The next time we meet, let's start there. We'll do it together. You'll report to me what you're feeling or seeing or smelling. We can walk around the room and find something together that we can taste or whatever it is. But I like doing it before anything else happens.
Great. No, that's helpful. Anything else that we didn't touch upon that you wanted to discuss?
I don't think so. Nothing comes to mind for me.
We covered a lot of good ground, I think.
No, this has been very helpful. I think it's great information and one that I think a lot of therapists don't necessarily think about all the time. So it's good to put into their mind so that they can treat their patients appropriately. Thank you both for joining me today. I appreciate you providing your insight into us, and it's very helpful and very informative. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us today.
Thank you for listening to this interview brought to you by the Vestibular Special Interest Group. For more information on this committee and the ANPT, visit www.neuropt.org.